Writer's Block, Season 5 of the Telly Award-winning podcast. A couple of knights in shining armor, gonna live forever, knowing together that we did it all for the glory of love. Wow, not too bad, right?
Yeah,
It would have been better if I would have did it in a falsetto, you know?
Sure. Gonna live forever. Sure.
This is my ignorance coming out. That's Karate Kid 2, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Little Peter Cetera.
Knowing together that we...
So good. Nice. I am Ryland Grant, with the Wicked Falsetto, screenwriter, Ringo Award winning creator of fine comics like Aberrant, Banjax, and The Jump, the other voice in The Dark, the decidedly not falsetto voice in The Dark, the man in the box.
I'm more of a baritone, really.
There you go. The man in the box to the left, if you're watching us on the YouTubes or wherever, is
David Avalone, writer of Things, Coffee Achiever. Very tired.
Yeah, a knight in shining armor from a long time ago. If you missed any of our previous conversations, episodes featuring other knights in shining armor, comic luminaries like David F. Walker, Matt Fraction, Stan Sakai, Kevin Eastman, Rodney Barnes, and many, many more, our entire catalog can be celebrated via YouTube, iTunes, not Spotify. We pulled out of that for various reasons. Email me if you want to know them. And other purveyors of worthwhile ear cracks. So double on back and check it all out. Great show today. I'm really excited. It's a guy that we've been meaning to have on for a couple of months now as we got our shit together with 100 books coming out. But you and I have some stuff going on. Avalone, why don't you give us the download before we bring Rich on?
Today, Drawing Blood number 2 is in stores. That's my creator-owned comic at Image, co-created with the amazing Kevin Eastman. It's a little bit of a very fictionalized autobiography. As Kevin likes to say, it's the completely fictional true story of a comic creator with a career somewhat like his. Oh, there we go. There's Drawing Blood number 1 with the Eastman Rodriguez cover.
Yeah. Very attractive.
Number 2, the C cover has the Eastman cover, the Bishop cover, and the C cover is Troy Little doing a tribute to Queen, which is very exciting and a fairly deep cut for the comic itself.
We're excited
to have that out. And Elvira meets H.P. Lovecraft 4 dropped last week. And that is still available. And because I only find out these things when I walk into a comic book store, the trade paperback of Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, Volume 3, containing issues 9 through 12 of my very first run, has finally snuck out the door from Dynamite. They tried to make sure nobody noticed, but it is available now at fine comic book shop. I was in a bunch of comic book stores last week, and it seemed like every store ordered 2 copies. Run on down, buy the one that they have left by now, and I'll sign it for you when you see me. Ryland, what you got going on?
Arm wrestle somebody for that shit. You know, movies. State of Consciousness is out there now with Emil Hirsch. Little sci-fi mindfuck that is that's interesting in its own way. The Big One, The Bad One. Haunted Heart will drop this summer. Just had a big sale at the Cannes Market with that one. Pretty cool.
Oh, nice.
That one stars Matt Dillon from Academy Award-winning director Fernando Treba. So really proud of that one. Love it. You know, one of the best things I've done. So go out and see that one. If you ordered issues 3 and 4 of The Peacekeepers, that will be headed your way very soon. You know, and look for the next Kickstarter. I don't know exactly what it's going to be. Could be a new issue with The Jump. Could be kind of a little, you know, Hitman romp, Guy Ritchie-esque that I have going on. I actually just put the finishing touches on a new Big Bad Sci-Fi deal also. So I may wait an extra minute and put that out. It's called The Breach. And yeah, that's a great one. So, lots coming, lots out. Yeah, go find it.
Nice. Well, let's bring in our guest, Rich.
Howdy, howdy.
Hello, Rich.
Hi, guys.
How you doing?
Welcome back to the show. We had you on, I can't even remember how many years ago it was now.
Oh, yeah. Must have been like at least like 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, it's been a while. It's wild to me that this project we started out of boredom and desperation in the pandemic. We're still kind of chugging along. haven't come up with a good reason to stop. But Rich, tell the kids at home a little bit about yourself.
Hey, my name's Rich Dueck. I'm a comic book writer. Written several original series like Road of Bones, which was nominated for a Bram Stoker Award, Sea of Sorrows, Breath of Shadows, Drive Like Hell, as well as I've done some licensed comics like short stories with in Superman Red and Blue.
Spider-Verse, actually.
Yeah, Edge of the Spider-Verse, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. So, yeah, I've been kicking around comics for like about a decade now. So, yeah.
Me too. I'm actually on my first comic was 2014, so I'm on my 10th year. Nice. I think I started writing it in August of 2014. So.
Yeah, and so most of you are listening on iTunes, Apple Pods, is what the youngins call it. So you can't see this, but so I have a 5 o'clock shadow going. Avalone is very well known for his very full, very luxurious mustache, but Rich has this badass beard that I'm just staring and marveling at. It is this aerodynamic wonder. I'm loving every second of it. So if you are just listening, I would hop over to the YouTube at some point and just take a peek at Rich's beard.
Just to enjoy the variety of facial hair.
Yeah. It's good. It was my pandemic project because I used to just have the goatee and then I just kind of grew it out.
I did the opposite. I realized about 2 months into the pandemic, realizing that I wasn't going to a barbershop for a year. I went full Lex Luthor.
Oh, nice.
And shaved everything. And you know how people like shave their heads and they're like, hey, I look pretty good. That was not my response. My response was I look terrible this. So I was
That's exactly what happened to me. Like I just started shaving my head and then I was like, I look terrible when I shave my head and I don't have like some kind of facial hair. It's just too much. I don't know. Look like the Kingpin or something.
Yeah.
The hair just crawled down your face. That was all that happened. A lot of people don't know this, but I shaved my head for 17 years. I started in college.
Nice.
I've seen pictures of that. Yeah. You know what? Yeah, exactly. And it fit in, when I spent a lot of time in the Zendo when I was teaching a lot.
I was going to say, was that a Shaolin monk thing? Because I know that's your background.
Yeah. Well, Soto Zen, wrote some Shaolin books because there are some similarities. But it was, I would say that probably extended the go about 5 years or something like that. What happened was at some point, I don't know if I made the mistake. It felt like a mistake back then, but I was like, you know what? I'm just going to grow it out and see what it looks like. I haven't seen it in a long time. And then this like luxurious head of hair came out and my wife was like, I could be married to that hair. Like, and she doesn't often put her foot down, but she put her foot down then. And she's like, you're not cutting it again. That's the end of that. So now
it's funny because my mustache is very much an outgrowth of my wife's very peculiar fetish, which is Barney Miller.
Oh, wow. That's a good one. Yeah.
And I always say, like, it's a good thing her ideal man isn't Momoa because that's not happening. I can't do that. But middle-aged Jewish homicide detective, that is a look I can nail.
Do you play the upright bass? Like that?
No, I don't play the upright bass. I can't do the theme. It is, however, since a friend made the point that I look a little bit like Jim Gordon these days. It is now my goal to write a Jim Gordon miniseries for DC and get them to convince them to let me do a cosplay cover.
There you go. Know,
standing That's in really front good. Of the bat signal, looking at a watch, maybe a walkie talkie in hand. But if you're tuning in late to this episode of Men's Grooming, we're talking about comic books. What have you got just to get to it? What have you got coming tomorrow? I know there's at least one dropping tomorrow.
Yeah.
Or today, excuse me. We're this will air quote unquote tomorrow.
If you walk into a comic shop today, you will see the Mechagodzilla 50th anniversary special from IDW. wrote that. That was a lot of fun because it was like really just they let me go kind of go wild with the mandate was how can we like kind of string 50 years of Mechagodzilla's history together. You know, nice. There's a lot of different versions. There's a lot of different narrative, you know, different, you know, there's Mechagodzilla, there's Kiryu, there's Super Mechagodzilla. So what I came up with was sort of like a, almost using like the structure of like Citizen Kane, where you've got like a reporter kind of going around interviewing different people about Mechagodzilla. Cause in this story, it's, he's sort of portrayed as like the defender of humanity against kaiju. And then he sort of like uncovers this conspiracy that uncovers the original connection of Mechagodzilla to aliens and stuff like that. So just trying to honor like the whole history of the monster and cram in a lot of like really cool different kaiju fights and stuff like that. The only one we weren't allowed to use was the, like the modern MonsterVerse one, like the one that was in, like, was it Kong versus Godzilla or something?
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like a lot of Godzilla heads don't acknowledge that as being real, you know, canon anyway.
It's not canon.
Yeah,
it's, I mean, it's not as far. It's not as hated and off canon as the Emmerich Godzilla.
Yeah, that's true.
It's in the world. Yeah, I did an Elvira versus Kaiju issue, Elvira in Monsterland number 4. And one of my favorite things to put into that is, you know, the premise of that is Elvira finds herself inside various movies. Uh-huh. She's in a Godzilla movie, and because she doesn't know which one she's in right away, she's like Atomic Metaphor, Symbol of Nature Gone Wild, or Playful Protector of the Home Islands. I really need to know which one you are so I can find out how to assess the situation. Mm. And I will say that I hadn't thought of it, but you know how comic books are written sometimes long after the solicit and the cover has been drawn. And I had no particular ideas beyond that it was going to be Elvira meets Godzilla. And Dave Acosta, God bless him, drew Mecha Elvira on a cover. And I went, there's my answer. Now I know how to have Elvira interact directly with Godzilla eye to eye. Mecha Elvira. Good. So yeah. I am obviously a fan of the genre.
Yeah.
I mostly based it off of Destroy All Monsters because that was a good way to get all of them in one place.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, no, no Mecha Elvira. However, I did my own kaiju book, Suicide Jockeys, about the lunatics who fight the kaiju, and I did it with this guy named Brad Warner, who worked for about 12 years in Japan making monster movies for a company called Tsuburaya Productions, which they are best known for doing all the Ultraman stuff, but founded by the guy who created Godzilla, and so I don't know, like the kaiju fans. They like the book because, you know, whatever, it's a good kaiju story. However, Brad is a historian of kaiju, and so there are all these little Easter eggs everywhere. And so I still get emails. Like, this book is, I don't know how old it is now, 5 years old or whatever, but people will email me and be like, hey, I tripped over this. And I can't believe on page 12 of issue 5 when you made that, you know, that Dogman reference or whatever. Like, I didn't think anybody knew about that. And it's like, well, to be honest, I did not know about that, but Brad knows all about that, and so he put that in there for you. But yeah, good book.
Yeah,
go see it. Go find it. Comic shops everywhere.
It's a large part of the fun knowing that you're writing for genre fans and that someone will recognize the reference. It might take a while. They might not get it right away, but you know, they'll get there.
Yeah.
I think the funniest thing with this one was like in the middle of the script, like I'm like writing and like, I'm like, okay. And Godzilla roars. And then I'm like, I have to write the sound effect. And I'm like, how do you translate that into, you know, sound effects? So I actually wrote my editor. I was like, do you guys have like a standard, like Godzilla roar, like that you use? And he's like, yeah, we usually use Skryonk.
Yep.
So like, oh, wow. Okay. Like,
you know, what's funny. I had the same problem, and I didn't, you know, Dynamite doesn't do any Godzilla books. Yeah. I looked up the, I think, 80s Marvel Godzilla pages on the internet and found the Scree Yonk thing. And I went, okay, there it is. That's that is apparently the official comic book transliteration of the Godzilla roar. And
I'm going to use it. Yeah. I'm trying
to find out. Though I don't know that that's, you know. And I, of course, because it's Elvira and you can break the fourth wall, the first time Godzilla makes that noise, she's like, I always wondered how you spelled that. Because she can obviously see the sound effects as they appear on the page. But you also do, like all of us, you balance the licensed stuff with the creator-owned stuff. And you've got a creator-owned book in progress right now, right?
Yeah, it's called Heart Piercer. It's a dark fantasy book. It's almost like you guys remember the old Ridley Scott movie Legend with Tom Cruise and Tim Curry. It's almost like an updated, like darker version of that. Not directly, but it has a unicorn in it. That's why I think I draw the connection. But basically,
and does it have the devil in it? Is that also?
Oh, okay. There's a guy with horns, but they're deer horns. He is pretty bad. Basically it's about a huntress who she was kind of tasked with killing all these magical beasts, and she believed that she was doing it in order to protect humanity, but it turns out that all these beasts, like the unicorn and stuff, were the only things kind of protecting humanity from an even greater darkness. So she winds up betrayed, stabbed through the heart, and thrown into the ocean. And she washes up, like, you know, after like a long, long coma-like sleep, to find that the world is now basically like kind of gone through this like magical apocalypse where it was just like overrun by things like werewolves and vampires and dragons and things. So she learns that basically it's kind of her fault because she killed the things that were holding it back. So she's not only out for revenge, she's also out to kind of like atone for that.
And when did you start working on this?
Couple of years ago is when I had like kind of like the first idea for it. And then was just developing it, and it was a in like pitch form for a while. And then I was talking to the artist on it, my co-creator, Gavin Smith, who we'd been friends for a while and we're just kind of like looking for something to work on together. So I sent him that and a couple of other ideas, and he really gravitated towards it. So we decided to do that together. We put it together, pitched it to Dark Horse, and they loved it. So here we are.
Had already done Drive Like Hell for Dark Horse. Am I remembering?
Yeah, it's kind of funny how that came about, because they actually both got approved like around the same time. And the reason was that I was friendly with a couple of people at Dark Horse, but the person I pitched Drive Like Hell to is an editor named Brett Israel, and he had worked on a couple of books that I thought were kind of like. So I thought like Drive Like Hell would be up his alley. So I pitched it to him, and then, they accepted it. But at the same time, I was developing Heart Piercer with Gavin, and I was thinking about like where to send it, but he sent it to Connor, who was his Connor Knudsen, who's his contact at Dark Horse, and Connor picked it up. And it was like, and Connor was like, yeah, I really want to do this. And then there was like a certain point where I was like, hey, I do have a book with Brett. I don't want it to be like weird. He's like, Brett and I talk all the time. Like I knew about that. Like, and don't worry about it. It's all good.
That's good.
Yeah. So
you've had a good experience at Dark Horse.
Yeah. Yeah. I think both books were like, really well received and well supported by the company. So very happy with like how that turned out.
I feel like there aren't a lot of companies in good standing like that anymore. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. I don't want to specifically badmouth other companies. However, I feel like there used to be three or four companies like Dark Horse, and now maybe Dark Horse is the only one. Obviously, Image is its own thing, and that's a different deal. And you got to love Image. But there aren't. Dark Horse might be the only Dark Horse left. And so I got to feel like it's a pretty good situation.
Yeah, no, there were definitely more more companies that were very reliable like just a few years ago. I'm doing a book later this summer with Mad Cave. I'll say like they've been really good.
That's good to hear.
I mean, like, I guess like the only one that I like would sort of like feel comfortable like talking about negatively would be Aftershock, just because that's not like really a surprise, like what they're going through. Like they're in the middle of bankruptcy right now. And I will say like the people there have been good as far as like, you know, being able to like talk to them and hear what's going on. And, you know, they've been like pretty transparent with what's going on, but it is kind of a bummer because The Ocean Will Take Us never wound up getting a trade. And, you know, I really would like to see that happen. So, but there's not going to be any kind of resolution until they're out of court. So we're just going to kind of wait and see.
Yeah.
There's so much of it going on right now. Yeah. And it's, And it's funny. And then it's like, you know, well, so it's like, let's all rush over to Dark Horse, you know, and Dark Horse is inundated right now. And if you have a previous relationship, then you're probably in pretty good shape. You know, they want to go with people they trust and know what bat, but it's,
Even Dark Horse is like I know their parent company did like a whole round of restructuring. So, you know, it's nothing like changed in that time as far as like, you know, our books or anything. But I know it's just got to be make it harder on them, like as a, you know, the people working there to like get everything done with, like, you know, not knowing who's going to be, you know. Tomorrow.
I will speak up for, I mean, I've been working for Dynamite for 10 years and they've actually been great to work with.
Great.
They're definitely a small company. And a couple of times I'm like, could you just hire three more people, put out all of these books that you put out? And I kind of am amazed and impressed with Nikki eating Disney's lunch a little bit, or I should say eating Marvel's lunch, because I have discovered to my great surprise that Marvel and DC do not want to publish kids comic books. Aggressively do not want to publish kids comic books. So someone like Nikki can come along and say, okay, you don't want to publish Darkwing Duck. I'll publish Darkwing Duck. I'll publish Gargoyles. I'll publish Space Ghost. What is wrong with you people? You know, the money being left on the table. And I was really curious about that. I mean, I will tell a little inside baseball. I write for a TV show called Batwheels. And I talked to a friend who is a now retired, anyone who knows him will be able to guess from context, a now retired member of DC's staff, and said, hey, do you guys want to do a Batwheels comic? Because the showrunner like is on board with me doing it and all that. And he's like, we don't want to do it. He's like, somebody asks me about every 3 months if I'm going to do a Batwheels comic, and DC does not want to do a Batwheels comic. And I was like, you're cool if I take it to another company, right? And he's like, yeah, fine, good luck. And that attitude, it's not his attitude, it's DC writ large's attitude.
It's a conglomerate attitude, and it's why the independent film business is gone, basically, because it's like, you know, because everything now is run by five conglomerates to whom, you know, making $5 million on something is the same as losing $5 million on something. You know, there's this old story that is like a bit hyperbolic, but not so much, that like, Bill Gates and his I'm the richest man in the world heyday, if he was walking from point A to point B and he saw $100 bill on the floor, it would actually cost him money to stop and pick it up. He made so much money every second that stopping to pick up $100 bill meant he was losing money rather than doing something else. and these conglomerates have the same thing. They don't want to make, you know, there was this, Cord Jefferson gave this like amazing speech when he was collecting his Oscar or whatever, saying, you know, it was a call to Hollywood being like, we don't need to make, you know, two or three $250 million films. We need to make, you know, let's make 35 million dollar films, 10 million dollar films, whatever.
Yeah.
That's where the art is. That's where, you know, that's what's going to save our business. And I think he's right, because it's like, they don't make the movies that we want to see anymore. Like, there's,
oh yeah.
You know, I, my wife and I, we used to love to sit down and watch TV. There's nothing on for us anymore. You know, the Ringer has the Prestige TV podcast. They don't have anything to talk about right now. They're talking about old 90210 episodes, like, you know, almost winking at us as they're doing it, because there's nothing to watch. And it's because they have, you know, because these conglomerates, like, they measure success in billions of dollars now. It's like, either you make $1 billion or you don't. Nothing else is worth their time. And so, that has ruined film, and it's ruined TV to a certain degree. They don't know how to make money. You know, again, making couch change to them is not worth it anymore. Yeah. But comics are the ultimate, you know, the ultimate problem there. And you're seeing it with DC. I mean, how long have we been hearing that, oh, DC is going to just abandon floppies? You know, they may, you know, they may publish trades to keep the IP thing flowing or whatever. But it's no longer worth it for them to publish floppies, because, like, again, you're talking about, you know, we might as well go dig in the couch cushions, right? And that is a really weird scenario, you know, that and the business is changing so radically. I mean, how these things are distributed, and even how the creator relationship, and that's a little more complex. But the idea that we can't make money off of a Batwheels comic, or that it's not worth it to do a Batwheels comic, is insane to me, because there's absolutely an audience for it.
Well, the thing that comics is suffering from is new readers. So why wouldn't you want to get a 5-year-old hooked on monthly Batman comics? Mm-hmm. Like, that's the future is getting a preschooler, you know, like, yep, getting a 7-year-old to be like, oh, Batman's cool. It's like, then you've got, yeah, a customer for 80 years.
Yeah.
And they're not, no. And for the longest time, comics are, I mean, the audience for comics, as we all know, is pitifully small in America, not everywhere else in the world, but here. And we're a rounding error. We are the R&D department for, yeah, major, yeah, movie studios now. And that changes how everything is done.
Yeah, well, and that's the, you know, again, that's the, yeah, that is the problem. The conglomerates are the problem, right? Is that it's not, mm-hmm, worth it for Warner Brothers, but, you know, again, you go into a company like Dynamite, and it's worth it. They've made it worth it, and they've handled their business. I mean, you saying, like, oh, I wish they would hire 3 more people. Like, the reason they're still around is that they didn't hire 3 more people.
Yeah, because I've
seen all these companies that Rich and I are dancing around talking about. It's like, mm-hmm, well, you know, these companies that are going under and they're having problems, and then they end up having to fire half the staff. And it's because they were doing well, and they're like, oh, wow, we're doing well. Look at this upward trajectory. Well, we need to hire 3, 4, 5, 10 more people to meet that. And then suddenly there's a bump, there's a turn, there's a pandemic, there's some comic shops close. And yeah, it's like, oh, wow, you know, those 10 people that we hire, we need to fire them, and we need to lay off like five or 10 more. Right.
Yeah. It's funny. It's because it's almost like that, that old ancient Greek saying, whom the gods notice, they destroy. So it's like, it's almost like, you know, comics is such a small slice of, like, the greater kind of, like, brand or IP business or whatever, that it's like, like Marvel Comics and DC Comics can kind of actually get away with, like, some stuff that they would never do with, you know, like, in a movie or a TV show or something. And it's like, and it's almost like if they were doing better, the pressure would be on so much that it would probably be like, you know, like, it would get to that point where it's like, okay, well, now you guys got to really, you know,
yeah,
you know, you're, and now that you're very important to the brand or whatever. So you have to, like, you know,
yeah,
tighten the ship up.
No, yeah. That's,
yeah. You know, yeah.
I'm the world's biggest James Bond fan, and Dynamite has had that license for 9 of the 10 years that I've worked with them, but I see what they're putting out, and I don't particularly want to write one of those. I, right. I, like, I, looking at their output, my not particularly well-informed opinion is nothing I'm going to pitch is going to be okayed by Eon Productions, the people that own the Bond license. Like, why should I bother pitching what I want to do with James Bond when London is going to say, nah, we're not doing that in comics with James Bond. I'm like, but it's comics, man. You like do whatever the hell you want. It's not going to have the slightest impact on the bottom line of the $300 million movies you're making.
Yeah.
You know, and also you're probably not making another one for 2 years until you find a new James Bond and get a script. So like fuck around, but I don't see any fucking around going on. So, you know, it has killed a little bit of my ambition to like, you know, I think the first thing I pitched to them was a pastiche version of The Death of Princess Diana, where Bond finds out that MI6 assassinated Princess Diana. And they're like, yeah, we're not even going to bother telling Eon about that. They'll never speak to you again if you try that. So,
yeah.
Like, that's fair. That's certainly fair. I just
thought I'd try it. Yeah, Rich is totally right, though. I mean, the fucking around is what brought me, you know? I mean, I had been writing, you know, film and TV for, I don't know, 10 years before I ever tried a comic book. And I just watched... You know, I just watched what you can do in Hollywood just shrink and shrink and shrink. And after about 10 years, you could fit it on a postage stamp. They were only making 5 different kinds of movies. They wanted them written a certain way. And I got pretty damn good at writing those movies. You know, it was like they built my house and everything. But it felt like a job. It felt like I was laying bricks. Like I would have enjoyed laying bricks more probably because I would have been outside and wouldn't have had this like tortured artist soul maybe or something like that, which sounds completely stupid. But the beauty of comics was like, well, anything you want to do, any way you want to do it, as long as it's good, you're going to find an audience for it. They're going to celebrate it. So when I went into comics, I was like, well, okay, I'm going to make this worth it. Like I'm not going to do a standard A to B to C formulaic thing. I'm going to double down on experimental elements and play with structure and tell things out of order and have unreliable narrators. And I just went all in on that stuff. And sometimes I felt like I was doing it too much. But the more I pushed with it, the more people were like, yeah, go, 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 go. And I totally get your point where I feel like if we had a little more success, a little more oversight, that people would be like, well, you can't do any of that. You gotta stop that. Yeah, no, that's not going to work anymore. And suddenly the formulas come in, and then we ruin this whole game. But
not to change, I want to get it out there. What's the plan with Heart Piercer? Is it 5? Is it 12? Is it open ended? What did you pitch, and what did they accept?
We pitched it kind of open ended. They approved 4, so we're going to do 4 and. You know, there'll be like a little bit of pause while everyone sees how it does. And then, you know, we're going to pitch like a volume 2 to them. I think like ultimately, like I would like to see it go somewhere between 3 and 5 volumes, but definitely going to pitch
3 and 5 core issue-ish volumes.
Or? Yeah. Yeah. Like, you know, 3 to 5 trades worth of material would be like ideal for me, but we're at least going to try to get another one going. So
yeah, and I always tell people that if I was writing it in this in the 70s or 80s, Elvira meets H.P. Lovecraft number 4 would have been Elvira Mistress of the Dark number 38.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and part of the old school fan in me is like, I kind of wish I was writing Elvira Mistress of the Dark 38 because that feels like a bigger achievement. But I don't, like, I'm not so cranky old man that I don't think it's perfectly fine to have these discrete storylines as discrete. Like, it works for trade paperbacks a lot better.
Yeah.
Like, well, they all get different titles. They have different, you know, feels to them. You know, there's a lot to be said for that process.
Yeah, it's almost like the kind of, like, the Hellboy model, I guess you could call it. That was, like, the first one that I remember where it was, like, each... like mini series coming out like had like a different title, and each thing had like a different title, and it was like sometimes longer between, sometimes shorter between, but you know, it's like it's just the realities of like production, you know, like I can understand Dark Horse not wanting to commit to like, you know, some like huge thing, like I'm not, you know, not like James Tinian or something where it's like it's guaranteed to, like, you know, sell like an astronomical amount. So yeah, you know, I just happy that we got it out there, and hopefully we get enough people being fans of it that we'll be able to do more.
And where are you at in the, I'm, you know, again, from, I think people have such a, fans don't really have an idea of how the work is really done. So I see you with a first step issue on the stands and I'm like, okay, so you're done writing those four.
Like
months ago.
I'm long done. I think I wrote the last script probably like September or October last year. Right. Maybe even earlier than that. And it's all done actually. I lettered everything. Everything's all finished. I think we were, when we solicited number one, which was back in, had to have been like March, all four covers were done. And I think, all the art, like the line art, at least up to like issue three was done.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and then it was just sort of like getting the last one out there and then getting everything lettered, things like that. Like, they want the covers in advance because like everything is like solicited a few months in advance. So they just want to make sure that they kind of have something to put in the, you know, catalog or whatever, to advertise with. So even if the issue itself is still being worked on.
I'm trying to remember if Dark Horse is one of the few that's still in previews, that's still in Diamond.
No, they're
in, they're out of Diamond too. They're Lunar.
They're in Penguin Random House now.
Oh, okay.
PRH, IDW's in PRH. I really think the only ones that are still with Diamond is Boom, honestly.
And Dynamite. And
Dynamite.
It's a funny thing because, you know, in the 10 years since I've been a comic book writer, it's gone from a book with Marvel and DC in it, with Dynamite way in the back, to like, now we completely dominate that book. And it's like,
it's crazy, right?
You know, yeah. And people sometimes are like, why are you guys still in Diamond? I'm like, because we completely dominate the book and it actually looks good. You know, it makes us look pretty big doing it that way. Yeah, but yeah, that the way that model fell apart so quickly like, you know, when Diamond shut down so quickly, I was like, wow, you didn't have operating capital to pay your employees for like a week.
Yeah.
that's pretty wild. And I get it. It's there, you know.
Well, my theory is like that Diamond's like kind of dirty secret, or maybe it's not dirty, maybe it's not a secret, but I think the thing that most people don't realize is they think that like comics is actually probably only a very small part of their total business. Yeah. They make most of their money on toys and games. So it's like the comic stuff, while, you know, is important to them, I'm sure, as a company, it's like if any other company lost like their top four accounts, they'd probably be out of business.
Right.
You know their top four or five accounts within the space of like 2 years, they'd probably be out of business. But Diamond has just, you know, sort of been able to roll with it because, you know, even though the comics shops are their biggest customers, it's like when you break it down by like the money they're making way more money on like stuff like Funkos and action figures.
The thing about the action figures and the statues is you can't order that anywhere else. You do have to get that from Diamond, and they do dominate that. I think Dynamite actually started as like, I think Dynamic Forces was like a back issue toy distributor to begin with. And that's what the publishing company kind of grows out of, which is an interesting model. And I don't know, you know, whenever I go in a comic book store now, I think and this is true of writing careers in comics too, is what else are you offering? Like, there's a great new store in Eagle Rock in LA called Revenge. They've got two rooms full of pinball machines. Which I think is a very smart thing to do. You know, having toys, having coffee shop, like
Meltdown had a comedy theater in the back.
My local store hosts punk shows like every now and then. Like, you know, the they'll just
and D&D yeah. gaming groups are also a big thing.
Yeah, they do that too
now, which is a smart model. But yeah, the whole idea of like, no, the monthly comics are going to keep us afloat. Yeah. You know, you see that less and less. You know, but yeah, you know, we've touched on this a little bit, but sort of, you know, might be good to talk about the state of the business between, like, me, go back and forth between licensed and creator owned, mm-hmm. and how different are those experiences for you?
Yeah, I mean, the similar thing about them is that it's like, you know, either way, it's like you've got a deadline, you got a job, you know, yep. and you've got like, you know, you got to write and you got to find like an interesting hook and things like that. I think like the big difference is that like all like the license stuff, it's just sort of like falls in my lap. Like there's never been a time where I've been like, hey, I really want to write like, you know, a Spider-Man story and oh yeah, sure, you know, we got one for you. It's always like, you know, I'll get like just like a random email out of the blue being like, hey, do you want to write you want to write Spider-Man? Or and I'm always like, yeah, sure. And then, you know, like I have way less control over like the timing and the deadlines, and at least for me, like who I'm working with. Whereas like for a creator-owned book, like Drive Like Hell, like I knew I was working with Alex. I know what Alex likes to draw. I know what Alex's strengths are, so I can tailor my script towards giving him those moments where he's really going to shine. Same thing with Gavin and Heart Piercer. Like I could, you know, really tailor the scripts with like the Spider-Man stuff and the stuff I've done for DC. It's like I didn't know who was going to be drawing it, like. Mm-hmm. Until like way after the script was done, you know, it was like, it was just sort of like I wrote the script and I had to, you know, keep in mind that not really sure who's going to draw it, not really sure who's going to color it. In some cases I've been asked like, hey, you know, is there anybody that you recommend or that you know you want to work with, and like I'll give a list of names or whatever, but most times it's just yeah, here's who we have available and they're going to do it, or you know, which is fine, you know, like I actually haven't been like disappointed with anybody. They've like
said that's great,
they've all done a great job. It's just that like the scripts I think can be a little less like tailor-made to like, you know, somebody. Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah. If you don't have that shorthand from working with someone and knowing what a panel description is going to get you.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. Having to be a little, the very first comic I did, the artist was excellent, but it took me about an issue to figure out that he was not a native English speaker and that my scripts were going into Google. I was like, okay, be real simple and precise with your language when you're describing, because anything even a little ambiguous, there's a possibility he's going to draw the wrong thing.
Yeah, I have this tendency to talk in imagery and metaphor and all of these things, and usually, you know, if it's a guy whose English is impeccable, that is a really good thing for an artist, right? However, yeah, you know, cut to you know, a guy in Brazil who's pumping it into Google Translate, or a guy in Indonesia, and he's like, what the fuck is this guy talking about? You know, and it's funny because my entire film career, I have been a guy who works with foreign directors, and Fernando Chueba, the guy that directed Haunted Heart, has said on more than one occasion that I was the hardest English speaker to understand. and not because he's not hearing what's coming out of my mouth or anything like that. It's just that, you know, again, I'm speaking with in slang and metaphor and all of these things. And you know, you're writing a script, you want the script to feel good, you want it to read well, you want it to be poppy and jazzy and all of these things. And yeah, that can be difficult for a guy in Indonesia who's trying to color your work, right?
As Neil Gaiman said, you know, a comic script has one audience member, and it's the artist.
Yeah,
who really has to understand you. Yeah. And that's what it doesn't matter what's, and I do the same thing. You know, when I'm writing a script for an Elvira, for example, they're supposed to be funny and they're being read by largely, you know, the main audience for that script isn't the artist. It's Cassandra Peterson, who has to love it and think it's great and we should do it. So I make sure that even the panel descriptions sound funny because I want her laughing while she's reading it. And then sometimes I have to go back to the artist and go like, ignore this, ignore, you know, like that wasn't for you. That was for Cassandra. And I've been very lucky in that regard, but I had an experience decades ago where a friend of mine married a woman from Taiwan who was a perfect English speaker, but idiom and metaphor complete. And I was like, right. You use a lot of not only slang, but old timey obscure slang that no one born before, no one born after 1950 is probably familiar with. So stop doing, I picked it up from my dad. So stop doing that, you know, especially for someone who's not a native English speaker, they are not going to know what any of that means.
Yeah. I heard a great story once from Andy Schmidt, who used to be an editor at Marvel and then IDW, but he was talking about working with an artist who English was not their first language. And I think the scene was like, basically like picture like a SWAT team or something. They're kind of like entering like a space station that's like was under attack or whatever. And they've got their guns. And like the writer wrote in the script, like, oh, like the lead guy sweeps the room, meaning that like, you know, like, you know, move the gun across to, which I think like most like native English speakers would get, but like the artist drew the guy like with a broom, like sweeping the room. Because it's like, and the guy was probably reading the script and being like, well, that's weird, but what do I know? Like, that's what he wants. That's what he wants, you know?
Yeah. I've had trouble with, you know, his jaw drops to the floor, you know, like his eyes bug out of his head. His, you know, it's, that is really funny. The thing that keeps popping into my head is, I mean, I feel like, I mean, a lot of our audience creators would be creators that whole nine yards. And we speak to a lot of people who are, I don't know, they're doing their own thing, you know, meaning they're going the Kickstarter route or whatever, or it's a mix, and you've avoided that, probably because you're working so much and, you know, in the traditional tense. I mean, as a guy who's still doing a lot of that, and I think a lot of people are turning away from it, I mean, I'm interested to hear from you, like, what the few companies that are left, because we've lost a lot of, you know, we have a lot of homies on the ground right now, unfortunately. But what are these companies offering now for a creator like me, like you, like David, like the people listening?
Well, not much, but I mean, honestly, like across the board, like most of them will offer enough of an advance per issue to kind of get the book at least partially done. Like some of them will offer page rates. Some will offer like enough of a page rate where, like, you know, like they'll pay the artist, they'll pay the colorer, they'll pay the letterer, they'll pay me as a writer. And generally what they get in exchange for that is a more favorable slice of the rights. Other companies might offer a flat fee that you basically, the creative team would have to divvy up on its own. And in my experience, for me at least, and my creative teams, what that generally is enough is to like cover the line art, like to give the artist like a decent page rate. And most of the coloring, depending on who you're working with. And then I usually take the lettering out of my end just to pay the letterer. And then you basically, again, like, I guess kind of like then the trade-off is it's like then like it's a little bit more of like an even split if there is a split. So, you know, a lot of companies are not like are doing it separate, like Dark Horse, it's not mandatory to sign like a media deal. Like they just really, the publishing stuff and the media stuff is kept very separate. I think they and Image are probably the only two left that do that. But yeah, you know, it's honestly like I've been looking at going back into crowdfunding because, you know, part of it is like, I have certain projects that, nobody really wants that I still want to make.
I mean, it just seems like with your bona fides that you, you know, you'd make a huge splash right now, particularly with the way things have amped up. And I just look at, you know, it ends up being my big thing where it's like, you know, with the jump, well, it's like I can, you know, with my eyes closed, you know, I can sell 20,000-30,000 copies of the jump in a comic shop and make almost nothing. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, I can get 300 backers on Kickstarter and end up with like 15-16 grand, you know, and it kind of only goes up from there, right? You know, that's with me not being there enough and all of that stuff. And I get to keep my rights and all that stuff. And so I just feel like this math problem changes every month.
There's definitely trade-offs. Yeah. And I don't think that like, crowdfunding or self-publishing is like a bad place to be. I just think it's like the roadblock as always is getting into comic shops. I don't know like the answer to that problem because there's a lot of like, you know, I think like one of the things with comic shops is like there's almost like two kinds of comic shops. There's like there's the ones that are very kind of like culture oriented, like, you know, like they're trying to make the space like very welcoming to everybody. And like they're doing things, like you said, like hosting D&D and, or magic or whatever. And like kind of building a community around themselves. And they are, you know, like supporting indie books and indie creators, and they'll have you out to do a signing. Even if like five people show up, they're still really happy to have you. And, you know, and then there's other ones that are just like for lack of a better word, like variant buying clubs. You might as well, like, it's like they sort of rent the store and then they just like order Marvel and DC stuff for their regulars. And if you walk in, it's like the Android's dungeon from The Simpsons where like, you know, they're just not open to anything other than what they're looking for. And it's like, and if they got an indie book, it's because like, you know, a really hot artist is doing a variant cover. And I call those
the Marvel DC Walking Dead shops.
Yeah.
Cause that's it. That's like their idea of indie comics is they have Walking Dead trades.
That's it. And you know, like it works for them fine, but it's like, but those are not like the comic shops that are going to be targetable for you as like a creator, either in self-publishing or with, you know, Dark Horse or Image or whoever, unless you have like, I don't know, like do you have like Bill Sienkiewicz's number and you can get him to do a variant for your book or something, you know, you're probably going to sell no matter where you are. So, you know, I think like honestly, like probably like the best of both worlds is something where like you do a Kickstarter and it does really well, and then you manage to partner with Image or Dark Horse or whatever.
No, exactly. I mean, that's the thing,
to distribute it to
you congratulated me on having an Image comic, but honestly, without Kickstarter, we couldn't have financed Drawing Blood out of our own pockets. You know, it's the most I've ever been paid to write a comic because I was the one signing the checks. You know, I said, Kevin, I would like X as my page rate. He was like, yeah, great, fine. You know, I was like, okay, that's double what, you know, I'm getting paid elsewhere, but it's a pretty reasonable rate for co-creating the book and all that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I remember the thing that made me feel bleakest about the industry years ago is when we went around with Drawing Blood. I won't name which publisher, but they said, "Yeah, we'll give you an advance of $1,000 an issue." Like,
yay. Yeah.
But you know, and I always tell people, like, the budget of a comic book, depending on what you, like, the lowest it is about $5,000.
Yeah.
Like, that's badly paying everybody. That's ripping off everybody and not paying yourself to write it.
Yeah.
But it's closer to $9,000 to $12,000 for a 20-page floppy with a cover.
Yeah.
God forbid you put a cover on. Like, the cover is $1,000 if you have a good artist, you know. Like, if you have Bill Sienkiewicz's number, $1,000 is not going to get you a Bill Sienkiewicz cover. So, you know, right there you've got a problem. And honestly, the problem with Bill is not having his number or it's getting in that schedule.
Yeah.
Honestly, because the man's busy. But
because there are a lot of people, you know, willing and able and desperate to pay him over $1,000 to do covers.
I'm trying to get him to do issue 9 of Drawing Blood. And, you know, like, issue 2 comes out tomorrow. That's how far in advance I'm trying to, like, no, Bill, you've got 6 months like to draw one thing. Can
And kind of like the way that all the problems that, like, the entertainment industry is having trickles down is that it's like you used to be able to kind of, like, make the case to say, like, as a writer, like, you used to be able to kind of, like, make the case to an artist, like, look, like, I understand, like, the page rate that we can get out of this for you is going to be kind of shitty, but, you know, if we get some option money, like, that'll, you know, most of it'll go to you to kind of, like, bring that up. And then if it ever gets made, like, we'll, you know, like, we'll do well. But, like, the fact that, like everything, like, in Hollywood and streaming and is such a mess, it's like, it's almost like you can't count on that anymore at all.
Oh, no. So, no. I mean, I will say that once I've had one experience where I reached out to an artist who was a complete stranger and asked her to do an 8-page piece for an anthology that was transparently a pilot for a creator-owned book that I was trying to launch.
Right.
And to my great surprise, she said, yes, like, I don't want to, it might have been like $30 a page, you know, like, I paid the colorist out of my pocket and I paid the letterer out of my pocket, but, you know, in the fullness of time, not that comic, but she got, you know, 2 Elvira series out of it. And, you know, that paid her mortgage for a year. So I, in the fullness of time, I was able to feel okay about taking advantage of her for the anthology.
Yeah.
And I will say that is my number one piece of advice for people trying to create pitch materials for comics, is try and get into anthologies and use them as a way to, cause, you know, I'm setting up a creator owned thing with Dynamite, actually. And, you know, I sent them 5 pitches. One of those pitches had 8 pages of completed beautiful art. Guess which one they liked? You know, not the 4 that required you to imagine what the comic was going to look like, but the one where they went, oh yeah, well, I can see this is great, you know.
Yeah.
So anything like that will always help you.
Yeah. And the other thing is that, like, you know, for an artist, it's like, you know, if you're a writer or a creator and you can't really, you know, I don't think anyone expects you to be able to pay Marvel page rates or, you know, high indie pay rates or whatever. But so it's like, I think everyone, you're not going to, like, insult anybody by just offering, like, what you can offer them.
Right.
But from the artist's point of view, like, if they like you, if they like the story, it's a lot easier for them to commit to 8 pages at that lower.
Exactly.
Than it is to be like, yes, I will sign on for your 500-page, you know, sword and sorcery epic for, you know.
And it is, isn't it a funny thing that the people coming from the absolute outside, it is such an interesting cliche that, like, people who have never published anything, the first thing they want to publish is always their 10-novel, 7,000-page epic fantasy series. It's like, you know what? Write a short story.
Yeah.
Like, let's hone this in, because no one's going to do that for you.
Yeah.
And I mean, know you've been thinking about it since you were 7 years old, and I get it. I have one of those too. We all have those.
Yeah.
But focus a little bit and do something.
I always tell people, like, don't do it because, like, when you first start, like, you're going to suck. Like, that too. You know, my first stuff, you know, like, I thought it was great at the time, but, like, looking back at it now, all I see are the flaws. So it's like, so, like, it really does mean that much to you. Take the time to get good at it.
Yep.
Good at what you want to do. Yep. And then do it.
And even when you're good at it, even when you're ready, you know, like, you know, when you look at how they do TV, it was like, you know, like Breaking Bad was not really pitched as this 100 episode epic. You know what I'm saying? Like it was one episode. It was a pilot episode. Here is a conflict. Here are rich characters. Here's a world that you're going to want to spend time in. If you can do that, if you can think about one issue, particularly now, you know what I'm saying? You make one good issue and then see where it goes. And you create questions in the first issue that need to be answered in subsequent issues and subsequent arcs and all that stuff. That's all you need to worry about is, like, I spend a lot of time encouraging people to do this, right? And I give them cards and I give them my email and I communicate with them. And I mean, it helps everybody, because you guys are hitting on this point where if you go to Dark Horse and you're like, it's this 100 issue thing where, you know, and if we don't have 100 issues, then we can't. And, you know, they don't want in on that. Like, you know, you have Rich, who is about as experienced as they come, award winning, all of this stuff. And they're like, you know what, Rich, we'll give you 4. Let's see how we do. Like, that is the best case. That is the best case scenario. Go ahead.
And I was just going to say, and like with like miniseries, like the standard miniseries length used to be 6.
Yeah.
And then it was 5.
Yeah.
Now it's 4 because it's like, you know, every issue they do is an investment on their part and, buying habits being what they are. Generally, by the time you get to 5, you're either even or in the red. And
But even as a creator, it's like I just see all these people that they have so much information in their head, and they're like, how do I arrange this, and how do I get it out, and how do I plan it, and what do I have to write to convey it, and all of these things. I'm like, focus on one issue. Just give me the first issue, right? And they're like, holy shit, just one? I'm like, yeah, just one. And then suddenly it all clears up. They're like, all I have to do is worry about this thimble. I don't have to worry about the fucking pitcher of water that was sitting over here that I didn't know how to sort through. And that's the beauty. And it's like, you know, sometimes I've had both cases where it's like, okay, well, you know, we want 4 issues of Banjax. We want 10 issues of Aberrant. We want, we want 5 issues of Suicide Jockeys. We want whatever. And I had to do that. I had to, let's tell a full story and try to set up the next arc and all that stuff. I've had to do that. I've had to map that out, give it to a publisher. But then I've done the thing like the jump, you know, like the jump. All I did was I sat down. I started fucking asking questions. I wrote the first issue. I had notions of what could happen and where it would go. No idea other than that. Right. And I wrote the first issue. I put out the first issue. People loved the first issue. They demanded more. And I'm like, okay, well, what the hell is the second issue? Right. And I sat down and I read through the first issue and I'm like, oh, there's that question. That's interesting. And I mentioned that and let me take those things and start to play with them a little bit. Right. That's fun. It's like, you're playing pickup basketball or something like that. And something really magical happens. Go ahead, David. I'm sorry.
I was going to say arguably the most successful independent art project in the history of mankind was started by my friend Kevin and his buddy Peter. And they absolutely intended it to be one issue and nothing more ever. It was a joke. They did a joke about turtles doing martial arts. And 2 months later, comic book shops were like, so when's issue 2 coming? And they were like, say what now? We killed Shredder. Like, what do you expect us to do? And God bless them. They let Shredder stay dead for a while. They didn't go to that. And one of my favorite things about that comic, I always say it's so aggressively unedited in that they're in outer space, I think, by the 4th issue. If that was like a Marvel comic, the editor would have said, can they just fight street-level crime in New York City for a year or two, and then we'll do Dimension X, and then we'll do the Triceratons and the We love Star Wars. Issue 4, they're in outer space. Fuck you. Like, that's what's happening.
And like it's like season four or five of the really right. good CGI animated series that they go to stage finally. Like,
fuck it. This is what we want to draw, so we're gonna do. And it is, and I say this with all the love in the world, and I've said this to him myself. It's like a story being told to you by an 8-year-old, where it's like, and then this amazing thing happens, and then this amazing thing happens, and there's no plan, there's no, you know, and then they're like, hey, we like Dave Sim. Let's do an episode, an issue with Cerberus. It's like, okay, great. We're going to do that. And there's a lot. I mean, I remember seeing an interview with the showrunner of Westworld, who I like to call the talented Nolan. And they asked him about plans for future seasons. And he's like, yeah, we always kind of leave some things hanging. But he's like, my plan for Westworld is always, this is the last season and I'm going to get off my chest whatever I wanted to do in this season. And yeah, there's, look, it's a science fiction epic. There's always going to be a thing I could do next, you know. But the Western town conceit only lasted 2 out of 4 or 5 seasons. Where it's like, yeah, no, it's still going to be true. Called Westworld, but we've seen our last cowboy hot for, you know, for 20 episodes now, because that we burned out. You know, we covered that. Now we're doing other weird dystopian sci-fi nonsense. And I think that is how you have to do it. And, you know, and I've had the opposite situation happen to me a lot, less so now because I've learned my lesson and I'd say, how about a 5-issue series? But Dynamite used to contract me for 4. And then in the middle of issue 2, they'd go, hey, 1 sold really well and pre-sales on 2 are good. How about 5? And sometimes I say, great. And sometimes I say, how about 8? And they say, fine. And in the first Elvira series, I got to 5 and they said, okay, now 12. I'm like, okay, I will tack another 4 issues on the end of this thing.
It could change the other way too. I had a friend who had a series that was like, announced and solicited to be 10 issues, and then around issue 2 they were like, listen, you know, like we're going through some troubles, can you get it done in 8? And he was like, let me think about it. And then like before he even got back to them, it was like, actually, can you get it done in 6? And it was like, you know, like, and he was just like, no. So, you know, they worked it out to where like he got the rights back and able to find like new publisher for it, but it was just like, you know, you don't have that same kind of like control over it that you would, I guess, like if you're doing it completely on your own.
Yeah. And look, sometimes you just, you go with the pivot and you go, okay, what can I do to wrap this up in 1? And how can I make this go 4 more issues without it seeming like I'm dog paddling?
Yeah.
You know, how can I find 1 more thing to say? And I can be kind of a hard ass as far as professionalism goes. And I'm like, that's the gig, man. Like if the company tells you crank out 4 more issues, then you find a way to make 4 more great fucking issues.
Yeah.
And and if they tell you wrap it up in 1, find a great way to wrap it up in 1. That's the gig, you know.
Yeah.
It's different when it's your own stuff, particularly when you're working on licensed stuff. You have to be prepared. You know, when I was a screenwriter more than I am now, whenever someone wanted to cut something really great or beautiful out of a script, I was like, well, this goes in the next one then. Like, I will, these ideas will always get used somewhere. Mm-hmm. You know, this character will get recycled and refashioned into something else. And that's, you can always, I always say the mark of an amateur is someone who has 1 idea.
Yeah.
And they're very protective of it, and they want you to sign an NDA before you talk about an idea. And I'm like, an idea? What's an idea? Everybody's got an idea. And then they tell you the idea, and you go, okay, that's actually Romeo and Juliet. That's not like a particularly new idea that you have. Oh, that's actually just your version of Star Wars. That's, you know.
Yeah. Well, there's almost this fear that, like, you're never going to have another great idea. So it's like, if you're too loose with this one, someone's going to do it and then you're going to have nothing. I think like the more you do it, the more you realize that the ideas are the easy part. The ideas always come, like, you know, like you might have like dry spells, but like, you know, once you start finishing stuff, it's like you finish it and you're like, okay, on to the next one.
That is the job. I've told this story before, but when I was 12 years old in the 70s or 14, I wrote a James Bond script. And the climax of the James Bond script, true story, was an old James Bond Spectre had taken over Alcatraz Island, and an old James Bond leads a Marine commando unit in an assault on Alcatraz. And when I saw the trailer for The Rock, no one read my 14-year-old script. I haven't read it since 1979, you know. Yeah. But the impression, the response isn't I got ripped off. The response is I am good at this. Because this was a great idea. James Bond and Marines attacking Alcatraz was a really good idea for a movie, apparently.
Yeah.
And rather than getting mad about my one great idea, I just go like, okay, like, you know. So, I got more.
Yeah. It's an incredible fucking idea for a movie.
Yeah, right.
Like, God damn it.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, I'm a little so sorry that I'm not the one that got to make it, but somebody made it. I got to see it on a big screen. Yeah. So that was
Michael Bay did a damn good job with that one.
Wrap up, but Rich, let's recap what you've got coming in the near term and where people can find you online.
Sure. Like we said, today, the Mechagodzilla 50th anniversary is out. Heartpiercer number one is out. Your comic shop should maybe have some copies left. And
that dropped last Wednesday, right?
Yeah, last Wednesday. And then issue two will be out on June 12th. And then July and August. Also in August, I have a graphic novel called A Phone Call Away coming out with Mad Cave.
That's a great title. That's
a crime thriller. Yeah. It's actually probably the first book I've written that doesn't have any weird supernatural or science fiction shenanigans or whatever. Like, it's just like a straight up crime story.
There's also no of in the title, which I thought was a little disconcerting. That's true.
Yeah. Well, you know, gotta move away from that. You know, I don't want to be like pigeonholed or anything. But that's all the stuff I've got coming like near term. We've got a couple of other projects cooking that are a little bit further out. But you can find me on my website at rdouek.com. That's R-D-O-U-E-K. I have a newsletter there you can sign up for. I talk about my stuff, the comics industry, advice for writers, a little bit like of a window into my process, stuff like that. So that's a great way to keep up with me. But I am on social media, on Twitter, Instagram, Blue Sky, pretty much all of them at rdouek. There's not a lot of us out there, so
it's nice to have a wacky name, isn't it?
Yeah. So follow me, say hi, and I definitely, interact with the people that interact with me. So drop me a line.
Cool.
Rock and roll. Speaking of wacky names, I am at Ryland Grant on all forms of social media. Most of you are just listening, so I spell it R-Y-L-E-N-D-G-R-A-N-T. I have to spell it because it's not a real name. My parents drunkenly arranged letters and saddled me with it, and so now I have to spell it for you all. But State of Consciousness is streaming now. It's still in a few theaters. Haunted Heart, my thriller with Matt Dillon and Academy Award winning director Fernando Trebo will be released this summer in theaters everywhere. So look out for that one. If you missed out on the Peacekeepers, you can go to peacekeepers.backerkit.com and get all the goodies there. You can also get jump goodies and autographed copies of Aberrant and Van Jacks and Suicide Jockeys and Rare Convariants. It is a one-stop Ryland Grant shop that you will very much enjoy. So check it out. I'm trying to think of what else I got going on. New Kickstarter announcement coming soon. I just don't know what it's going to be yet. One of three very incredible and amazing things. I am going to leave now, though, and I think I'm going to watch The Rock, probably followed by Con Air.
That one I did not pitch Con Air when I was a small child.
Yeah, I wrote that when I was about 10. Yeah.
Nice. At some point on this podcast, I will share my experiences with Con Air director Simon West. Great guy. Had a ball with him. One of my first dining out moments in Hollywood. That's not this episode. Maybe we'll have Rich back on and cover that. But bring it on home, David.
Actually, the second half of the Rock double feature is View to a Kill. Because I did not mention that the Blofeld gets away from Alcatraz on a blimp.
Yeah.
And James Bond fights him on a blimp in San Francisco Bay. So that script was full. Like when I was 14, I was finger on the pulse. David Avalone is a shockingly easily Googled name, which is very helpful to me. Today in comic shops, go in and get Drawing Blood number 2. If you didn't pick it up, demand to get Drawing Blood number 1. Very nicely, we went into a second printing, so there should be also, thank you, there should be also the second printing, if not the first, of Drawing Blood should be available. Elvira Meets H.P. Lovecraft number 4. Last issue of that is coming up next month. And on your TVs, if you have Max, the second season of Bat Wheels has my first episode, which is called Air Show Don't Tell. Bat Wheels just expanded to Netflix. Only the first season is on Netflix now, but watch Air Show Don't Tell. I got to write Catwoman for the first time in my life. And
great,
that was a
great title.
That was a big thrill for me. And also me and the showrunner conspired to keep in my filthy joke about Green Arrow and Black Canary for the preschoolers to enjoy. So that's a fun episode. And also coming soon, there is a Kickstarter, I believe, for a Planet of the Apes role-playing game. And I wrote a fistful of short stories and character bios for that. Nice. And the short stories were great fun. I got to write George Taylor, a character I've loved since I was a kid, the Charlton Heston character.
Charlton Heston.
But I also got to write character bios for people who have one line in Escape or Conquest from the Planet of the Apes. So that was a fascinating stretch.
Get your damn hands off me, you damn dirty apes.
Yes, it was fun. Those were very fun stories. I think the Heston stories will be in a book called The ANSA Files, which is the version of NASA from the Apes movies. But that's it for this week's exciting episode. Thank you, Rich, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We will see you all on the next one.
I just realized I haven't kissed you in over an hour.
If you're watching us on YouTube, be sure to smash that like button. If you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts or other fine purveyors of ear crack, please leave us a 5-star review. And wherever you're watching and or listening, subscribe, subscribe, subscribe. We'll see you back here next week for more Madcap hijinks on The Writer's Block.
For more information, visit pendantaudio.com. Thanks for listening.